Okay, so my hero is Petra Todd. I put this up here because if you need a reference, she has wonderful slides on methods. And Heckman and Rubin are brilliant. Reading their papers can be challenging. Petra Todd does a beautiful job of writing summaries, so if you need that, go to that. Can experimental methods advise policy outcomes, both for ex ante policy implication and ex post? Ex post can be, we're in a federalist system, you know, so you maybe want to evaluate state implementations and apply them at a federal level or not, right, or a state level, so forth. So the types of policies, this list could be hugely extended. Disclosure is a big one right now, and I'm going to kind of focus on that, but limiting choices, we heard before that, some comments to that, opening, closing of a market, education, we talked, Margaret talked about, lots more, okay? So field experiments are in the Dodd-Frank, as Gene sent me this, trial disclosures are written here in the bill, saying, you know, we should test these things before just implementing. All right, I'm not going to, you can look that up if you want more on that. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to lay out some identifying assumptions. In other words, if you're going to do experiments, whether field experiments or natural experiments, you want to make sure that after all that effort, you got it right. Right? So that's the goal here. I'm going to lay out those assumptions in words. I'm not going to put any math up today. And you can go to Petra. She's good. And in the process, we'll talk a little bit about behavior and heterogeneity, which has already come up as super important. Okay? So here's a problem statement. Let's assume a policy has been implemented, and we observe the outcome, and I'm going to use this treatment terminology. We observe an outcome of those with treatment and those without treatment. The problem is we don't observe the counterfactual of what those who were treated would have looked like had there been no treatment. Okay? It's the simple program evaluation literature, right? So what the treated would have looked like, this we've referred to this as the average impact of treatment on the treated. And then we also really what we're interested in as policymakers is this average treatment effect, was what the effect of the policy treatment would be on the population. And the difference in there, these 2 points, is that those treated may not be representative. This is a huge issue, right? That if you're going to implement a policy, you need to make sure that your design of evaluating either, say, one state's policy or the trial disclosure, that you're getting representative sample, and the treatment might have spillovers, okay? Let me just give you 2 quick examples. Mortgage disclosure. We could change mortgage disclosure today and say, oh, well, let's match people up on income, and then we could compare them. Well, the problem, obviously, here is that, well, the environment of what the disclosure has an impact now after the news reports about disclosure and the bad product, this and that, is not at all the same. So this comparison is completely invalid. A second example, financial literacy. Okay, the research has long struggled with the causality of teaching of finance and long-term outcomes. All right, Lusardi's got work in this, and Margaret's done a lot of work. And it seems like, and I apologize, Margaret's work gets around some of these issues. But, you know, we love the idea of financial literacy, but when we talk about doing testing, often we say, well, we're going to have this program, and you've got voluntary selection in. We know, though, that people that select in are not representative of the population at large, and that affects outcomes. Okay, so we have to deal with these things statistically before we implement, go, you know, gung-ho with these experiments. We really need to be serious about these things because we want to get it right. Okay, I'm going to talk about 3. I'm sorry I'm talking fast, but I want to cover a bunch of things. I'm going to talk about field experiments, which, in my opinion, is the best method. The statistically randomized control trials are the way to go if you could do it. I'm going to talk about natural experiments, which can be very appropriate, and regression discontinuity if I get to it at the end. Okay? Field experiments, randomization. Randomization is beautiful. You can have a control group not exposed to the policy treatment. You can make sure that that control group is representative. very, very important, of the, this counterfactual of what the treated would have looked like had there been no treatment. Critical to be, again, precise up front in the design. I'm going to talk about that in a second. Randomization. There's some math behind this in determining how big of a trial you need. But this is not infinity. But getting it right up front, again, get the math done so you have enough power to identify what you're trying to identify. Okay? So I'm not telling you how to do it. I'm just saying know that that's important. Okay? Internal and external validity. Here are the kind of the two biggies in terms of getting the field experiment right. Internal validity. Must have, the people that are treated must have the same distribution as the people that are the control sample, right? I'm using this terminology as if we're doing drug testing, right, because that's where it came from. But here's the hard part. There must be the same distribution on observables and unobservables. Okay, so matching on income and education, which is nice and lovely, it doesn't work unless you can make an argument that those are completely representative of the things you care about. I think I give an example, maybe in the next slide, of what, a case that that might not be true. Choice-based participation. I already kind of said this. It always struggles with representativeness because the people that choose may look the same in income and education, but there's something about them, their behavior. We're talking a lot about behavior that makes them agree to participate. And since now we're actually paying attention to behavior, whatever that is going to may matter. It may matter for, we were just talking about privacy. It probably matters for privacy, agreeing to participate. Uh-oh. Wait, this doesn't count on my time. Okay, good. So it's often better, rather than doing choice-based participation, to have the control group be within those that agree to participate. Okay? Now that you can say, well, wait a minute then, you still have this bias here of choice, who's going to participate. Now we're talking about external validity. External validity, does that group that chooses to participate, are they representative of the population at large? And this is certainly a problem. It's less of a problem than this is. So get this one right first. Okay, external validity certainly matters for when you're going large, the whole country with the program, but it's less crucial. I borrow most of this from Petra, this slide. Problems that can arise. I'm not going to go over these so much. There are lots of them. I do want to go over this one, which I enhanced. Ethical concerns. So, withholding treatment, if you've got the cure from cancer, the medical research struggles with this a lot, right? It's hard. We're in the same boat here for policy. Political unfairness. If one jurisdiction decides they're not going to withhold treatment from someone, in addition to getting into the morals of that, but statistically, you have implementation bias there as well. The one I really care about, the moral part of lowering people's utility. So we talk a lot about innovations, and it's really nice, and I'm going to pick on Hal for a second because I can apologize to him because we're in the same city. But say you show a picture of me old, right? You show a picture of me old, which he's going to show you. It's kind of cool stuff. And when I'm taking out cash or something, I don't know what. But it made me feel bad looking at me old. Now you've lowered my utility, right? And so I think we need to think about these sort of things, about where we're going with consumer finance, with all this data and things we're learning about people's behavior, because utility is not just about money. Sorry, Hal.
No.
I love your stuff, but sorry. I had to have an example. All right, I'm going to cover this paper real quick because I think it's relevant that I wrote with Marianne Bertram. So the idea here is about payday loans. Even if payday loans, let's just forget about the debate about whether they're good or bad, even if they're priced fairly, you have to think that cognitive limitations or bias by some borrowers might explain their use. Okay? So the idea here is that rather than our experiment is, what if you mandate disclosure that's a particular type? It's a debiasing disclosure. So it's informed to what mistake is being made. This is the key concept. If you know for a particular decision, this is not general, it's a particular decision what mistake is being made, you could target the information with some debiasing strategy, right? And so what we do is we do a field experiment at National Chain of Payday Stores and see if we can impact borrowing, future borrowing. So the idea is, what's the mistakes? Well, maybe the mistake is that people may not internalize the APR. Okay? So what do? We make very salient the APR. Okay, payday loans are expensive. And we put it in context of comparison to others, not that they can switch over to these other products, but just to make it look expensive. Okay? All right. Treatment number two. Maybe people don't add up the cost of a decision over time. We know it's true. There's narrow bracketing, narrow framing, the psychologist would say, peanuts effect from Markowitz. So we add up the cost of a payday loan. If you don't know a lot about this product, the fees add up from cycle to pay cycle to pay cycle. And in 3 months, if you took out a $300 loan, you're paying $270 in fees. Okay, so we make that stark, you know, put it in terms of dollars. Information treatment three, maybe people fail to consider adequate variance in the future outcomes, or they're overconfident about their abilities to pay back the loan. So we give them a distribution of refinancing to reset their expectations. So just to give them an idea of how other people struggle to pay back this loan. Okay, now, the psychologist in the room will say fairly, which is true, we brought attention to the expense in all three. Okay, so we can't disentangle that, but we're going to look at the economic magnitude of one versus the other. Random assignment, right? So this is a methods talk. Let me just mention here. We randomize. We pay a lot of attention to get this randomization right. When we test characteristics, we do testing of whether this randomization across the different treatments was fair. Challenges. You know, in the paper, it's kind of you just write a line or two about, well, we did this and that. We struggled a lot. How do you get the clerks to be uniformly giving the information? We did lots of training. The stores are not comparable, so you can't randomize by store. You can't randomize by customer because the clerk can't keep track of it. So you randomize by the day of the week, but you've got a day of the week effect. The people that come in on Friday are not the same as Monday, right? I'm just trying to illustrate. It's hard. Estimation details. Well, the observation counts are not the same per store. You could weight the regressions by count, but also the stores have shocks that everyone in that neighborhood face those shocks, so it's not independent, so we cluster by store. It becomes very restrictive econometrically. Just trying to say it's hard. Okay? Results, what we find is the dollar information treatment, you know, that adding up, not the APR. The adding up is what lowers borrowing. And we do it on a number of methods. Now, again, we cannot reject that bringing attention to one of the treatments or another isn't the cause, but the magnitude is largest and most consistent for the dollar information. I highlight this in red. If you're running different treatments, you have to pay attention, of course, to the fact that if you run 100 treatments, one of them is going to show up significant, or probably five. Right, so you have to do some joint tests, and in our first round we forgot to do that. We had a good referee remind us. All right, conclusion of that paper: debiasing failure to add up over time reduced borrowing. The dollar treatment. Then we do heterogeneities that I'm not going to cover here, but the dollar treatment is most effective on those without higher education, and the self-controlled who are able to act on that information. So the paper generally advocates for really understanding that bias or whatever it is that's affecting the decision at that point in time, and then having debiasing disclosure. Okay? All right, alternative methods. I have 5 minutes. So I want to just quickly talk about natural experiments and regression discontinuity. Right. So natural experiments are observational data. And within the population of interest, a sample is exposed to a treatment. So in the context here, maybe one state has already implemented a different privacy law or something like that. Okay? And the paper I wrote about payday loans is about natural disasters and using natural disasters as a natural experiment to financial distress. So it wasn't caused by your decisions or by what's going on in the community. The buzzwords here, difference in differences, triple propensity score matching, all these things, right? Let me just go through a quick example. So a state implements a policy. Difference in differences would be to compare that state to another state over time and see if their trends are impacted by that. The problem with that is, of course, these things may not be comparable. So here I have, for example, there's a disclosure change in New Mexico or Delaware, and say they match on observables, which they don't. But we know for a fact, New Mexico and Delaware are going to have different culture, have different perceptions of regulation, different social provision of good. So it's hard to do this difference in differences just matching at state level. You really have to pay attention to the details. Propensity score matching is just a method to match on all observables. You have to then assert that there's no missing factors. It's hard. If you can do it, it can be very powerful and, of course, cheap because it's observational data. Okay, so, I'm not negative on this. It's just hard. In fact, so my other paper, which was actually my dissertation, and I got a job off this, so it seems okay, that what I did was look at payday lenders again in California, and I did this triple differencing thing around the natural disasters. You know, the problem is, of course, locations with payday loan stores are very different than locations without payday loan stores, even if natural disasters are exogenous. So I needed this triple difference because, basically, I don't have time. Let me just explain. So basically, what I assert is that if you have a trend, you can get the trend between two locations with payday loan stores. And you can say, well, the change in welfare is a pattern, and those two haven't been hit. Those two assert the pattern of the trend of payday loan stores and welfare. I'm not saying this well. What I'm differencing around is the disaster, the difference in the pattern. Let me show you an equation. So, for example, that we can look at, think of this W as foreclosures, that foreclosures in locations that have a payday loan store that are impacted by a disaster compared to places that are impacted by a disaster that don't have a payday loan store. But we need to benchmark that against the pattern that we would have seen for locations that don't have disasters, both with and without payday loan stores. So I apologize if I didn't say that. Well, the idea here, though, is that we have this natural disaster, but it's not enough. You know, you really have to pay attention to what the patterns would be to get the natural experiment going. I find that for foreclosures and small crime, that the existence of a payday lender helps people in disasters. Now, I usually get an uproar from that. There are people that borrow from payday lenders that are not in financial distress. I'm not speaking to those people and the use of finance in that setting, but at least this provides evidence that we need to think about alternatives for people in distress. Before going after, generally, that this is crazy expensive finance. Okay? All right. Regression discontinuity, which I can do in 1 minute. Whew. All right. So, assumptions. The idea here is, and I'm going to show just a picture rather than talk about this, which I know is fuzzy, but I borrowed this. Okay, so the idea of regression continuity is there's some rule. So the one of the famous starting papers was, the rule was about college admissions. You didn't know what score on the SAT would get you into Dartmouth, but when you sent in your application, but there was a distinct rule there. And so then looking at just the people right around that rule, because they were close on all other observables, right? And so it's this right around the rule. What we're looking for here is the discrete jump in securitization of mortgages right around the rule of the FICO scores at 620. This is from my colleague Saru as well as Keys from the board here. And so you see at 620, I know it's fuzzy, but I had to paste it, that there is a jump in the rate of securitization of mortgages. And so they can look at just these people and speak to the loan performance of just around this rule. Okay? So regression discontinuity provides another kind of observational way to think about evaluating policies either before or as you're implementing, if you can think about where there might be a rule that doesn't affect the consumer decision but is going to affect the outcome. All right, and I'm sorry I went so fast, but I wanted to cover those three things. Field experiments, just to wrap up. Field experiments allow for randomized control trials, which I think are really valuable. Policy implementation is too important because it's hard to change policy. So it's too important to not run trials. We're in a second best behavioral world, and honestly, it's hard for economists to guess outcomes. I mean, it's just true. And this, you know, if you're thinking about the cost, it's cheap relative to missed policy. Okay? But if you're going to do this, take the time to get the econometrics right before you start. And make sure the implementers don't have an agenda. Okay? All right. Don't exclude these other possibilities that I squeezed in, the natural experiments and regression discontinuity, because they can be valuable. But again, you know, you need to make sure the identification restrictions are right. I know.